Valon's a sad day for the occupied West Bank. Two Palestinians, both in their 20s, are killed in two separate acts of Israeli violence. Big crowds attend funeral processions across Iranian cities to commemorate martyrs of the Iraq War. And scenes of chaos and violence in Kazakhstan, a fifth day of protests against the government turns deadly. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. It's been a violent day in the occupied territories where Israelis have killed two Palestinians. The Israeli military carried out a pre-dawn raid on a refugee camp near the city of Nablus in the West Bank. That prompted local residents to protest and led to clashes between the two sides. A 21-year-old Palestinian identified as Bakir Hashash was fatally shot in the head separately. An Israeli settler ran over a Palestinian man in a village near Ramallah and killed him. He was only 25. Hamas has reacted to the killings. The spokesman for the movement says the blood of these martyrs would only intensify the Palestinian intifada against Israel. According to Hazem Qasem, Palestinian youth will not give up their resistance until their land is freed from occupiers. Here's our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, with the latest about today's deadly violence. Take a listen, please.
Israeli forces raided the refugee camp of Balata, East Nablus, in order to conduct a rest campaign, according to a statement by the Israeli military. However, there were clashes. According to the Israelis, there were clashes and Palestinians opened fire at the Israeli troops. Then there were clashes from the two parts. The Israelis shot and killed at the spot Bakir Hashash, 23-year-old from the Balata refugee camp. They say that none of the Israeli soldiers were wounded. The other Palestinian who was killed this morning was Mustafa Falani from the village of Safa near Ramallah. According to his relatives, he was going to his workplace in the lands occupied in 1948, and he was crossing the road. One Israeli settler ran over his vehicle, and of course, he left them and ran away. He escaped. Also, this morning, at least 20 Palestinians were detained by the Israeli forces across the occupied West Bank. Those Israelis claimed that they are wanted for security reasons.
Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash is suspending his hunger strike after 140 days following an agreement by Israel to release him. His hunger strike, which is one of the longest ever, brings to the fore the years-long challenges of many Palestinians that are held captive in Israeli jails for undisclosed allegations.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but is finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity. Thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Cities across Iran have held funeral processions for 250 martyrs of the war with Iraq that took place decades ago.
من در مناجات از خدایم خواستم که باشد اگر بال و پرم گمنام باشم.
The processions were held in 24 provinces. The Iran-Iraq war took place over 8 years during the 1980s. Former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein launched a military invasion of Iran with support from Western and regional states. Well above 200,000 Iranians are estimated to have either lost their lives or gone missing during the war. Over the years, the country has been carrying out search operations to recover the remains of those missing. The search mostly spans Iran's southern and western regions, which border Iraq as well as areas inside. It borders Iraq as well as areas inside Iraq as well. Excuse me. Iran says the United States and Israel are obstructing the complete elimination of chemical weapons in the world. Addressing UN Security Council session, Iran's deputy permanent representative to the UN expressed deep concern about the U.S. non-compliance with the Chemical Weapons Convention. Zahra Ershadi stressed that the U.S. is the only member state of the convention which still possesses chemical weapons. She added that Israel must be forced to join the Arms Control Treaty immediately and without any preconditions. The convention bans the use, production, and stockpiling of chemical arms. The Iranian envoy further highlighted Syria's commitment to destroy its chemical stockpile. She said the UN Security Council's monthly sessions over Syria have no justification when the convention's implementing body has approved the elimination of Syrian weapons. Political commentator Jason Unruh says the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons is refusing to investigate the U.S. or Israel's chemical arms programs because it's fearing punishment.
I think that very clearly the reason the OPCW does not investigate Israel or the United States is, frankly, because if you try to investigate them, the United States would punish them for doing so. We do recall when the International Human Rights Court wanted to investigate the way the United States treats its prisoners, they slap sanctions on individuals who may serve as the judge. We've had Israel threaten them on more than one occasion that they would retaliate if they investigated them for the constant crimes against humanity that they actually commit. So it's very clear that this double standard exists. The reason the OPCW does not carry out these investigations is simply because the one with the largest guns will not let them.
Iran's top negotiator in the Vienna talks describes as positive the ongoing negotiations between Tehran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal. Ali Bagherikani says the participants are working to get the ultimate results. He says an agreement to effectively remove anti-Iran sanctions can guarantee the success of the talks. He noted that an agreement could be reached faster if the other sides are ready to accept Iran's proposed mechanism for verifiable removal of sanctions and guarantees that the U.S. will not abandon the deal again. Iran and the remaining signatories, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, are engaged in their eighth round of talks in the Austrian capital. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and is not directly involved in the talks. We've reached out to political analyst Sayed Mohammad Marandi For his take on the latest round of the Vienna talks, he says the only thing that needs to be done at this stage to achieve a success is for the U.S. to return to compliance with the 2015 deal.
During the current negotiations, as we speak, it's the United States that has left the table. The United States left the nuclear deal. The Iranians are saying if the United States wants to re-engage, if they wanted the P5 plus 1, which became the P4 plus 1, to become the P5 plus 1 again, then they have to implement the deal. It's not very complicated. The Americans and the Europeans are dragging their feet, but it's quite simple. This has already been negotiated 6 years ago. With regards to the JCPOA, the Iranians negotiated extensively with the United States to reach the deal. And what happened immediately after the deal? Obama began violating the deal behind the scenes. He told the Treasury to threaten banks not to cooperate with Iran in violation of the deal. And then Trump tore up the deal. So every time Iran engaged with the United States, it was stabbed in the back. The Iranian position is clear. The Iranians expect a full implementation of the JCPOA. They expect a strong mechanism for verification, because last time around in 2015, that was one of the major flaws of the nuclear deal. The Iranian side, the Iranian commitments were all quickly verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency, but there was no verification mechanism for the Americans and the Europeans. And they took advantage of that. As I said earlier, the Americans violated the deal from day one by imposing new sanctions, but also by dragging their feet with regards to implementation. This time around, the Iranians are saying the verification process and the assurances have to be clear.
We're seeing fresh updates about the situation in Kazakhstan, where a fifth day of deadly unrest triggered by soaring fuel prices is ongoing. Local media say a total of 12 police officers have been killed and 350 others injured in clashes with protesters. Also, security officials say dozens of people have been killed in battles with police in Almaty overnight as they try to storm government buildings. The unrest has already triggered a national state of emergency and the resignation of the prime minister. President Kasym Tokayev has appealed to a Russian-led alliance of ex-Soviet states for assistance. The alliance says it would send peacekeeping forces to help stabilize Kazakhstan. U.S. President Joe Biden is keeping a lot more migrants in detention than his predecessor, Donald Trump. An Instagram post by independent news program Democracy Now! Says U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is holding more than 22,000 migrants in prisons. That's 7,000 more than the Trump administration. Rights activists are calling for the detention centers to be shut down, and the call has especially grown louder since COVID rates have started spiking and conditions inside jails have deteriorated. The advocates argue that there's no social distancing, which puts detainees at greater risk of infection. The U.S. Attorney General has vowed to hold accountable anyone involved in the last year's attack on the Capitol building by supporters of former President Donald Trump. The stern warning by Merrick Garland comes the day before the first anniversary of the violence. The Justice Department, headed by Garland, has charged more than 720 people with various crimes, including assault on police, to conspiracy. Those people, about 165, have pleaded guilty, and at least 70 have been sentenced to various jail terms. A large mob of Trump's fans stormed the Capitol on January the 6th, 2021, in a failed bid to derail the formal congressional certification of his 2020 election loss to President Joe Biden.
In late 2020, Americans went to the ballots to pick the country's next president. 4 days after votes closed, Joe Biden was declared the winner. But the incumbent leader, Donald Trump, alleged vote fraud, and in doing so, shattered Washington's self-proclaimed image of the cradle of democracy. Trump adamantly refused to concede defeat after losing the 2020 presidential vote. On January 6, 2021, he called on his supporters to march on the Capitol and, quote, stop the steal. His fans attempted to do that. The world was shocked as news networks around the world showed thousands of Trump supporters forcing their way into the Capitol building, the symbol of U.S. democracy. Lawmakers engaged in the process of certifying the presidential election had to stop their task and flee for their lives. Some reports even suggest that a Republican senator was so frightened that he asked the Capitol security repeatedly to shoot the protesters. 5 people died in the chaos, one of them in the Congress building. To date, American authorities have arrested nearly 600 people and are looking for hundreds of more suspects. A big portion of the defendants stand accused of assaulting police officers. The FBI asked US citizens to report each other out and tell the police if they knew anyone who had taken part in the riots. The incident inevitably had adverse consequences for the United States' image, both domestically and internationally. An opinion poll conducted last year by Harvard University showed that more than half of the country's young generation thought that American democracy is in trouble or failing. Moreover, an Axios survey indicated that now only 51% of the US public thinks the next presidential election will be fair and free. Also, the Democracy Perception Index for 2021 showed that 44% of participants perceive the US influence and meddling in the affairs of their countries as the biggest threat to democracy in their nations. At the same time, politicians and political analysts express shock and disgust at the chaotic scenes at the Congress grounds. Richard N. Haas, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, said the attack signaled a post-American era. The assault on the Capitol changed the face of Washington, D.C. as well. The Congress building was fenced off on multiple occasions after the riots. Furthermore, Joe Biden's inauguration was carried out under heavy military presence, with an unprecedented 25,000 troops ensuring security. That was bigger than the number of US forces present in Iraq and Afghanistan on the same day. The police reaction to the Capitol riots also raised questions about the US law enforcement's differential treatment of white protesters. Whereas black people could be killed and injured for much smaller crimes, police were in fact criticized for their late and subdued response to the deadly protests by Trump's supporters.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The world's 10 richest billionaires added roughly $402 billion to their collective wealth in 2021, a year marked by continued suffering and economic dislocation fueled by the global coronavirus pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, In 2022, Let's Tax the Rich. 10 billionaires added $402 billion to their fortunes in 2021. Stay tuned for more. The world's 10 richest billionaires added roughly $402 billion to their collective wealth in 2021, a year marked by continued suffering and economic dislocation fueled by the global coronavirus pandemic. Heading into 2022, the 10 wealthiest individuals in the world are all worth more than $100 billion, CNBC noted, citing the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, which tracks and ranks the fortunes of the planet's richest people. Representative Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, said recently that the staggering growth of billionaire wealth amid the worldwide public health emergency and economic crisis should compel Congress to finally redress the fundamental injustices of the U.S. tax system. Jayapal said, in 2022, let's tax the rich and invest in our communities. At the top of the billionaires index at the close of 2021 was Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk, who added over $121 billion to his wealth last year as the pandemic both took and completely upended lives, pushing tens of millions of people into poverty and intensifying pre-existing inequities. Just behind Musk on the list was former Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, who tacked $5 billion onto his net worth in 2021, leaving him with a total fortune of $195 billion. In November, the head of the World Food Program, WFP, outlined a proposal by which Musk, now the richest man in the world, and other U.S. billionaires could donate just 0.36% of their pandemic wealth gains to help 42 million people facing starvation. The $6.6 billion required would help those in most need in the following way. One meal a day, the basic needed to survive, costing 43 tenth dollars per person per day. Averaged out across the 43 countries, the WFP said this would feed 42 million people for 1 year and avert the risk of famine. The billionaires have not taken the WFP up on its modest plan to save millions of lives with a fraction of their pandemic profits. The investigative outlet ProPublica reported in June that Musk, along with other U.S. billionaires, paid $0 in federal income taxes in 2018. Late last year, Musk garnered widespread publicity for selling off a portion of his Tesla stock, triggering a significant taxable event. But as Bob Lord, an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, observed in a recent blog post, Musk has paid tax in 2021, lots of it because doing so was by far his best option. Did he pay more tax than any American in history, as he claims? Probably Lord wrote, but he also received compensation of more than $20 billion, which almost certainly dwarfs the compensation any other CEO in American history has ever been paid from a company with profits not remotely commensurate with that level of compensation. The updated billionaire wealth figures come as Democrats in Congress are struggling to chart a path forward for their flagship social spending and climate legislation, which has been held up by corporate-backed Senator Joe Manchin. The House-passed version of the Build Back Better Act includes a surtax on millionaires and other measures to help fund the bill's investments and reduce out-of-control inequality. According to the Washington Post, Manchin recently told the Biden White House that he would be willing to support some version of a tax targeting billionaires, an idea that the West Virginia Democrat criticized in October. While the specifics of what Manchin would support remain unclear, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Ron Wyden has unveiled a tax aimed at the accrued wealth of America's approximately 700 billionaires, the Post noted. The measure is aimed at addressing the massive gains of the wealthiest Americans with a federal tax and probably would be unprecedented in how few people it affected. Congress nonpartisan scorekeeper has estimated it would raise as much as $550 billion over 10 years, or pay for more than one quarter of the Democrats' spending bill. In a social media post on New Year's Day, the Patriotic Millionaires, a group composed of wealthy supporters of progressive taxation, warned that history paints a bleak picture of what happens to extremely unequal societies. For the well-being of rich and poor alike, it's time to confront inequality and choose to tax the rich, the group wrote. If you don't, then all the talk at Davos won't change what's coming. It's taxes or pitchforks.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the illegal act of detainment without charge, Israel is the one that has taken the lead in this regard. But this act is being defeated through Palestinian hunger strikers like Hisham Abu Hawash, who was detained without charge or trial. He ended a 141-day hunger strike after reaching a deal with Israel to be released on February 26. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why Israel continues this illegal act while the world stands idly by and watches it, along with other Israeli atrocities that continue in the occupied territories.
Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for 141 days, but is finally breaking his fast because the Israeli regime has agreed to release him next month. Abu Hawash has been receiving a great deal of support from the Palestinian people, who have rallied, protesting his unjust detention and demanding his freedom. And now these people finally have a reason to celebrate. In Al-Khalil, Abu Hawash's home, his supporters have turned out to rejoice this victory against Israeli jailers. His family had an especially tough time in recent days after doctors warned that Abu Hawash's health was deteriorating, that he was slipping in and out of coma and facing the danger of sudden death. Now they can finally breathe a sigh of relief.
I thank all the Palestinians who stood with us. Thanks to everyone who helped my brother. I thank God they released him.
During the past 3 days, we lived through a psychological war that was carried out by the Israeli intelligence due to what was happening with my brother Hisham. There were strong maneuvers, but we overpassed those as a family. Today, Hisham achieved victory for all the Palestinians.
Now, Abu Hawash's lawyer says he would be hospitalized for medical follow-up before his designated release on February 26. Palestinian officials have weighed in, praising his resistance.
Hisham Abu Hawash prevails after 141 days of hunger strike. We hail Hisham for his forceful will, his family, Palestinian people and people around the world who raise their voices in solidarity, thanks to countries that press Israel to release him next month on February 26.
Resistance movements have also poured praise on Abu Hawash, saying his victory should remind Palestinians how they can win every battle against Israel. The 40-year-old father of five children was arrested in October 2020 and started his hunger strike early 5 months ago to protest his detention without charge or trial that is allowed under Israel's administrative detention system. His lengthy hunger strike once again shed light on this illegal practice. Out of 7,000 Palestinians in Israeli jails, more than 500 are locked up without facing any charges or having a trial. For many of them, the last choice against this inhumane measure is to stop eating for lengthy periods of time. Still, the majority find themselves locked up in deplorable and non-standard conditions of the Israeli prisons, where they are sometimes even subjected to systematic torture and harassment.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Charlotte Case. She is an international coordinator at the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us, Mazen Kumsaya, Palestinian scientist and author, who joins us from Bethlehem.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both, and Mazen Kumsaya, let me first start with you. Administrative detention may be familiar to us, but maybe for some it's not. If you can please explain to us what it is that is causing this controversy, what is the definition of it, and why does Israel, in this case, employ execute it?
Well, first we congratulate the family of Hisham for finally having this agreement to release him and thus breaking his fast. He is one of many who are subjected to these cruel and unusual circumstances that are forbidden by international law. We have to remember that Israel is breaking records in these things. It's breaking records in having the longest held political prisoner, Nail Barghouti, over 41 years in prison so far. There's other people, stories that are really sad, like Nasser Abu Hamid, who has cancer, who's also fasting. He entered into a coma yesterday. He's been in prison since 2002. And he has four brothers who are in prison. Their home was destroyed over five times. Another cruel and unusual punishment that Israel engages in. There is Khalid Fasfus, who has entered into his 131st day of fasting, and his life is also threatened. So there are stories upon stories upon stories that one could tell, all in violation of international law, that Israel does its thing and gets away with it.
All right. Charlotte Cates, our guest there, and we appreciate Mazen Kumsaya for mentioning some of the other people who are actually in Israeli jails, and some who are on a hunger strike that are continuing with it. Why do you think Israel agreed to actually release this particular prisoner, given the fact that it could have opted not to? But Hisham Abu Hawash was able to get a deal with Israel and for Israel to then release him. And why is it that is seen by many as a big success when it comes to Palestinians?
Well, administrative detention, I mean, which is the particular kind of imprisonment under which Hisham Abu Hawash was held, is a form of torture in many ways, including psychological torture, because of the fact that Palestinian prisoners held under administrative detention never know when they are going to be released, and neither do their families. They're not able to make plans for the future. They're not able to think about what they're going to be doing in the future because of the fact that Israel even refuses not only to charge them or to try them, but to even give them a date of release. The reason why Hisham Abu Hawash, and of course many other hunger strikers in the past, have been able to extract the victory from the occupation is because of their own steadfastness, their own resistance, their leadership in the Palestinian prisoners movement, which plays a leading role in the Palestinian liberation struggle, and of course the power and strength and commitment of the Palestinian resistance, which repeatedly expressed its commitment to see the liberation of Hisham Abu Hawash and to see the liberation of all Palestinian prisoners. And so Hisham's victory is not just a victory for himself, but one for the entire Palestinian National Liberation Movement, and really for all people who care about justice in the world. Right now, there is a boycott of the Israeli military courts that's being carried out by over 500 administrative detainees. And this gives that entire movement strength and further support to move forward and to win a victory against administrative detention.
What is this thing that you just mentioned about the court? If you can just elaborate for us briefly.
Sure. Well, on the 1st of January of this year, the administrative detainees, there are over 500 Palestinians held without charge or trial under indefinitely renewable administrative detention orders, which are put in place via a secret file. And they're among over 4,500 Palestinian political prisoners in total held within the Israeli occupation prisons. They announced on the 1st of this year that they were launching a full boycott of the Israeli military courts and higher courts, because these courts are nothing more than a facade that presents the false image that there is some kind of legal process going on, when in reality there is nothing more than rubber stamping the arbitrary detention orders of the Israeli intelligence service, the Shin Bet.
Sure. And that's important. And if you can tell us, Mazen Kamsaya, why this boycott is important. Because from what I'm understanding, it takes away the legitimacy that Israel wants to portray, as our guest there said, if I'm correct to understand it that way.
Indeed. You know, Israel claims to be the only democracy in the Middle East, when it is the worst offender of human rights in the world today in many, many aspects. It's an apartheid racist regime that has two sets of laws. One set of real laws for Jews and one set that's reserved for the what they consider inferior human beings, which are the native Palestinians, indigenous people. Our lives here are guided basically by the whims and whimsical interests of military commanders who obviously have only one interest in mind, which is the advancement of colonization on our land, which means more theft of land and more destruction of homes. That's basically the whole process of colonization, built on this idea of giving it a quasi-legal structure, so that the world, it's a public relations thing, so that the world says, well, there is Israeli courts and so on. But as pointed out by the other speaker, these are only rubber stamping, basically, whatever the military and the Israeli government decides to do to finish off and liquidate the Palestinian struggle.
Okay, let's get a little bit beyond the prisoner plight here, of which we have talked about somewhat briefly. And I'm looking, Charlotte Cates, at something that's very disturbing that I see every week, if not daily, but I see it every week. And I'm not too sure if the world is seeing it every week, but they should. And my point of reference here is a source by the name of Palestinian Center for Human Rights. And when I look at the weekly report that comes out in this particular website of the different violations that happen in the occupied territories, among the different ones, which is a long list, the one that I'm reading, December 23 through the 29th, the Israeli military had 101, in 1 week now, 101 incursions into the occupied West Bank, including occupied East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. 60 Palestinians arrested, including 6 children. 1 week. Every week, more or less, along the same numbers, if not more, sometimes less. Why is this not being highlighted in order for the plight of people, for just this one particular reason, which is the illegal detainment? Why isn't that just being highlighted when it's happening on a weekly basis?
Well, in 2021 alone, over 8,000 Palestinians were arrested during the year. And of course, sometimes when we look at the number of prisoners, the number of arrests, we don't really see reflected in those figures. And this is especially true for child detainees because of the fact that they might be held for several days. And during this time, they're subjected to solitary confinement, to military interrogations, to various forms of torture and abuse. And, you know, even if they are released afterwards, rather than being sent to a military court, the severe effects of that kind of mistreatment on Palestinian children continue to affect them for years and years to come. And so sometimes even when we talk about the fact that there are 200 Palestinian children right now locked in Israeli occupation prisons, it doesn't convey the full sense of the violence that's being committed against Palestinian children and against the Palestinian people as a whole. In Samidun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, and many organizations around the world are working hard to bring attention to this issue and to free all Palestinian prisoners, and of course to bring in Zionist colonialism throughout occupied Palestine from the river to the sea, because this is the only way to really bring an end to these kinds of ongoing violations and ongoing attacks. And there are many organizations that are involved in this effort. And so one of the most important things that people can do when they hear about this situation is to get involved with a group in your area, get involved with building the boycott of Israel, get involved in sharing this information on social media, because the imperialist powers that are allied with the Israeli occupation are not going to tell this story for us. Instead, it's very important that we tell this story ourselves and do everything we can in the streets to build power and give support to Palestinian prisoners who are leading in the resistance and the Palestinian people who are fighting back for liberation and return.
Sure. And this fight back came recently, something that was hailed across the Palestinian territories, Masih Humsaya, and that was the breakout that happened, or jailbreak that happened by the six Palestinians, which was described as a Hollywood-style escape from an Israeli prison. It was hailed as a big deal. And tell us why that is, and tell us whether that kind of sparked what we're seeing, acts of resistance, which is an increase, as we've now seen, with these Israeli hunger-striking prisoners.
Yes, and you know, the breakout of an Israeli prison like that was a heroic act, and it's almost like a Hollywood-style movie. That they managed to escape from maximum security prison. But I do want to add one thing to what was said about the prisoner situation. There are groups that try to defend prisoners, including Defense of Children International and groups that are prisoner rights groups. Israel is actually outlawing these groups, and they have outlawed 7 human rights groups just in the past 6 months. And those 7 human rights groups are considered by Israel to be quote-unquote terrorist groups. So even human rights groups and groups that defend prisoners are outlawed here. And effective resistance is being targeted in every aspect, regardless of the form of resistance. It's not just armed resistance, but any kind of resistance, any kind of nonviolent even resistance, any kind of demonstrations, any kind of even expression of opinions on Facebook and other media outlets are considered taboo and prevented here and are attacked here, and the people are punished for them. Israel has developed a system of repression that really is the envy of fascists and Nazis, for example. I think they have really created a system that's very, very strong and mean and powerful. But in opposition to that is, as we said, we are struggling and we engage in boycott and we engage in divestment, sanctions, and we... We are very proud of support of groups like and people like Desmond Tutu, who died recently, a friend of mine, and others. Really, we are very grateful for international mobilization, and the right will eventually win. I am very, very hopeful, and I'm very optimistic about this.
Well, the landscape as it stands, and maybe you can tell us if you agree or not, Charlotte Cates, is it looks like Israel is penetrable. When you take a look at what happened with that prison break, when you take a look at you know, how this hunger strike that was conducted, in which a deal was set and Israel agreed to release him, the topic of our program. When you take a look at the most recent Gaza war, where you had these rockets actually penetrate the so-called Israel's Iron Dome system, and also many reports coming out saying that the Israeli army, its soldiers, they're not really even prepared for a war. It kind of shows Israel in a weak state. Is that correct to look at Israel that way?
Because, you know, Israel has a lot of weaponry. It has a lot of technological power. It's given $3.8 billion a year by the United States, which, you know, there's been another $1 billion added to this. And this money goes straight to weaponry, right? And so you also have the unlimited political and diplomatic support given by not just the U.S., but other imperialist powers in Europe and Canada and elsewhere. But what you also have is the fundamental weakness of the imposition of a Zionist regime in the middle of this region as an imperialist outpost. And there's a fundamental illegitimacy to that project of Zionism within the region. And this is being rejected by the Arab people, by the people of the region, and certainly by the Palestinian people. And so when we see things like the victories of the Palestinian resistance, when we see things like the growing strength of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza and elsewhere, when we look at the six prisoners who escaped in this heroic, you know, action from Gilboa, one reason why this inspired Palestinians everywhere, inside Palestine and exile and diaspora, and also people struggling for justice in Palestine everywhere around the world, is because it exposed the cracks and flaws and weaknesses in this technological superiority that is enjoyed by the Israeli occupation state. And so all of this must actually inspire us to redouble our efforts to strengthen our work to build the boycott and isolation of Israel, because we know that it is possible for Israel to lose. We know that it is possible for the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people to win. And so this is the moment to escalate solidarity. This is the moment to escalate the isolation of Israeli apartheid immediately.
Okay, you talked about that very well. And Mazen Kumsaya, the rejection of Israel and what it is doing has been, since you mentioned Desmond Tutu, I'm making a comparison here, that the apartheid policies of the Israeli regime, the comparison is made there. And many have concluded, whether it's analysts, politicians even, that you know, this is not going to last. You even have Hollywood rejecting Israel. I'm not going to name the Hollywood actress who recently displayed solidarity with the Palestinians, because I'll get faulted for mentioning her name in terms of any endorsement, which obviously I'm not going to do. But even there, where Israel is set to have a hold on Hollywood, it's being rejected. What will it take then for this regime to lose the right of doing what it's doing in the occupied territories?
I mean, oppressors do not easily give up. They do not easily hand over power. Oppressors have to be forced to hand over power. They have to be forced to do what is right. That's why it's essential to apply this pressure in all aspects of resistance, all aspects of boycott, divestments, media work. All of this is very, very critical. I think the biggest obstacle actually for us is not the power of the Israeli military might. The biggest obstacle for us is the collaborationist Arab regimes and even among the Palestinian leadership, who think that Israel is invincible and that Israel is here to last forever, and you might as well just collaborate and have normalization with it, like the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and others have done. Those are much more of a danger to us than the military might of Israel or its support from the West. There was a lot of support and military might for South Africa under apartheid, and it crumbled because of public pressure. But the important thing, just like with South Africa, not to have too many Chief Buthelezi of South Africa, and not to have too many people here of the Palestinian leadership who meet with Israeli military leaders and wait for the crumbs of the table to come down their way. This is a big obstacle for us. That's what we have to overcome.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. We're fresh out of time. Mazen Kumsaya there, Palestinian scientist and author from Bethlehem. Charlotte Cates, thank you so much. International coordinator at the Samadan Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who spoke to us from Vancouver. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. From Mikko Vitahvay, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Ya maulati. يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا زهراء
يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا زهراء يا مظلومة يا مظلومة يا مظلومة
Jamadi Afrani III. To the strongest and most probable beliefs, it is the day when the whole heavens cried for the martyrdom of Lady Fatima Zahra, the princess of all women of the world. Affliction and agony will invade hearts of all Muslims every year on the martyrdom anniversary of Fatima, a candle in the wind.
والحزين ما له حضيب تعد ما يقدر يجافيني صح بفريحتيج ابتسم والفرح ما ينسيني يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا زهراء
يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا مولاتي يا زهراء يا مظلومة يا مظلومة يا مظلومة يا زهراء
Lady Fatima was a daughter of Muhammad and Khadija, wife of Ali and mother of Hassan and Hussein, and one of the five members of Ahlul Bayt. She became the object of great veneration by all Muslims because she lived closest to her father and supported him in his difficulties, and because of historical importance of her husband and her two sons, and that she is the only member of Muhammad's family that gave him descendants numerously spread through the Islamic world. Muslims regard Fatima as a loving and devoted daughter, mother, wife, a sincere Muslim, and an exemplar for women. It is believed that she was very close to her father, and her distinction from other women is mentioned in many hadith. Fatima Zahra most of all resembled her father in her looks, character, behavior, and conduct. She's the princess of all women of the world. Various aspects of Lady Fatima's life in the words of Tahsin Fatima Razavi.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, we're going to carry on with analyzing the life of our great lady of Islam, Hazrat Fatima Zahra. And we have seen so far the role played in her short-lived life that had, at this moment and at the present time and throughout history, had mellowed the dominant roles of people and groups like the feminist, and have taught them, have taught us that by mellowing down our role and concentrating on each individual parts of our, so as to say, multidimensional role which each woman and man has to play, we have learned that there are better and supreme goals that one has to attain, and we must aim for those goals. Now, to carry on and look at the life and how Hazrat Fatima Zahra showed us these and taught us these lessons are an example from her life and her, for instance, multiple skills that she had of eloquence and her political and social expertise and the powerful insight she showed at various stages. For instance, there was a time when a woman had come to Hazrat Fatima Zahra and had said that I have a weak mother who has many questions with regards to worship. And the woman carried on asking the questions, but the questions came one after another, and she carried on to the extent that she had to come another day. And the next day she apologized to Hazrat Fatima and said, maybe I have taken too much of your time, maybe I have tired you. But Hazrat Fatima Zahra in return said, no, ask anything, because it's like a man who has to transport, for instance, a load to the top of a mountain for 1,000 dinars. What do you think? Would it bother him? Because at the end, he's going to get so much money. The woman replied, no. So Hazrat Fatima Zahra said, my reward for every question that you ask is similar to imagining the whole of the space of the earth from the ground to the divine throne full of pearls. Now, with this, we see what Hazrat Fatima Zahra is trying to say. We see that if a woman concentrates on knowledge, acquiring knowledge, and then passing on that knowledge to help others to solve their problems, this is the reward we gain by helping them. There are events in the following manner about Hazrat Fatima Zahra and her bravery. She was apparently present with the Holy Prophet and at times with Imam Ali in roughly around 30 wars and battles that took place at that time. Fatima Zahra also shows her bravery when she goes into public and society and demands for her rights, for her usurped rights, namely the Garden of Fadak back, when Imam Ali, her husband, was dragged to the mosque to pay allegiance to the ruler that he did not want to. She faced the time when her house was set on fire. She faced the time when during the attack at her house, she was wounded and she was beaten. And due to that, she had miscarried her child, Mohsin. In fact, it is Fatima who has trodden this path of perfection, as we have seen from her life. And because of this, she is a guide for other women to follow. This all shows the importance of the role of Hazrat Fatima Zahra. Hazrat Fatima Zahra, by her very small life and every act, every behavior, every step that she had taken and every word that she had uttered had become an example and a lesson for us that at a time of such corruption, at a harsh times, at times of sorrow, she was still as strong as anything and stood against all this because she believed in the message sent to the Holy Prophet, which was displayed in practice by her husband Imam Ali. It was the divine message, so she believed in Allah and she followed on the course of the path of the divine message and thus practiced it in her life.
مولاتي مجني العقل يا الزهرة عشت بحيرة مو هم أصحاب النبي ما